The shooting spree in Arizona that resulted in the deaths of 6 people and the injury of 14 others has prompted another round of soul-searching about one of the most contentious topics in American politics, gun control. It's a subject that has many fault lines, from changing legal interpretations of the Second Amendment to the fact that our homicide rate is the highest in the industrialized world. We will examine how all those issues are connected on this week's Backstory segment, and we are joined by Harvard University history professor and New Yorker contributor Jill Lepore. Welcome back to our show.
Thanks.
In the most recent issue of The New Yorker, you examine how legal interpretations of the Second Amendment have shifted over time. What did the writings of the time tell us about the original reasoning behind the Second Amendment?
Well, unfortunately, the writings of the time are just in some ways murky in that people had a lot of different opinions in the 1780s, as much as we have a lot of different opinions about this matter today. So one of the big reasons that the Second Amendment is added to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights is that there was a great animus against a standing army in the 1760s and 1770s in both England and America. The idea that the government could have an army was a big part of the reason behind the revolution in the first place, and the idea that therefore citizens ought to have the right to arm themselves and form militias to resist the possibility of a tyrannical government using its own army against the people had a wide purchase in the new United States. So there's that. There's this, you know, strong argument in favor of militia as a fundamental right of a citizenry that has concerns about a tyrannical government.
So in 1792, a year after the Bill of Rights was ratified, Congress passed the Militia Act, which compelled all, quote, able-bodied white men of certain ages to have a battle-ready musket or rifle. Does this mean that many men didn't own rifles at the time, or at least many white men didn't own rifles?
Yeah, that's actually much disputed. And, of course, one of the things that's important to remember is how long ago we're talking about and the kind of – when we're talking about guns in the 18th century, we're talking about a very different piece of equipment than a Glock. So I think the evidence about how widespread gun ownership is has been quite controversial. It was a great controversy a number of years ago when a historian published a book looking at probate inventories and claimed that very few men were actually armed, and his data was later questioned, and the book was actually pulped.
There must have been a reason that Congress felt compelled to pass this law on top of the Second Amendment.
Yeah. I mean, it is not, you don't see, I mean, reading in the archives of the daily lives of ordinary people, you don't see a lot of people mentioning their guns.
Well, it's the first example we have of the nation forcefully compelling its citizens to purchase arms to defend themselves or to defend the country.
And what you see later on in the 19th century is gun ownership is actually fairly closely tied to slave patrols. It's in the South, especially by the time we get to the antebellum years, starting in the 1830s. That the very vigilant attempts to stop slaves from escaping to the North so that the entire North becomes free by the 1830s, and there's a fairly widespread traffic in runaway slaves. So a lot of the arming of the South has to do with slave patrols. It doesn't have to do with fear of a tyrannical government. It doesn't have to do with hunting. There are many different reasons that people own guns, but that is a big piece of what happened in the 19th century.
Some people have tried to argue that the Militia Act somehow provides a legal precedent for the health care law, since it mandated that citizens purchase something. is the Militia Act still on the books?
I don't know if the Militia Act is still on the books, actually. There have been a lot of reasons, like the healthcare proponents in the 1940s looked to a fairly obscure act signed by John Adams in, must have been 1798, for merchant seamen to get free medical care when they retired from the Navy. And that somehow formed as a precedent for healthcare. I think the more interesting question, though, and I think maybe what you're kind of moving towards is, do we really look to the 1790s for an explanation for how we ought to think about violence in our society today or how we ought to legislate about violence in our society today?
Well, we don't hear the word militia very much unless we're talking about some survivalist group in Michigan or Ohio.
No, militias are not, I don't think, a part. Ordinary militias, the mustering of ordinary citizens on the town common as a public-spirited activity to prevent against an invasion or for concern about the government's own army, taking our liberties away is not a part of American life.
Was the Second Amendment something that was argued in the courts in the 19th century, or is this something that has only been an issue in the 20th on?
There really was actually, in fact, a widespread consensus in the 20th century about the meaning of the Second Amendment. It was long discussed in the courts and among legal scholars as protecting the rights of citizens to form a militia, and therefore in some ways analogous to the Third Amendment, which is often referred to as the Forgotten Amendment. Can you name the Third Amendment? Do you know what the Third Amendment protects?
I do not.
See, no one knows the Third Amendment.
I'm having problems with the Fourth Amendment, too.
This is one of these pop quizzes that I always, you know, I'm given at home. My kids always say, can you name the 13 colonies? Can you name the Fourth Amendment? The Third Amendment protects you from the government forcing you to quarter troops in your house.
Oh, yeah.
This was a live issue in the 18th century, indeed. The Quartering Act in 1764 really offended the citizens of Boston. The British Army actually, you know, used it and kicked people out of their houses. And there were sieges of poorhouses that were taken over by the British Army. It was a devastating and really important issue. And it's bound up with the same set of fears of a standing army, that is, an army kept by the government in times of peace that could potentially be used by the government against its own people. That's what's so fearsome about a standing army. And so quartering was one of the great evils, and that's why you had to have a militia, and that's why you needed to have protection in the Third Amendment against quartering. So for much of the 20th century, legal scholars have argued that the courts interpreted the Second Amendment to be pretty much like the Third Amendment, and that in the sense that it protected something that we don't really consider ourselves needing much protection from anymore. You know, the government is not telling you you can't have a militia, but maybe we don't really need them right now. We don't have the same set of ideas, in the same way that we don't feel actively necessarily passionate about the quartering act just now.
But people didn't talk about gun control or limiting the access to guns when we had presidential assassinations or attempts on presidents' lives in the past. It really came up after the Kennedy assassination, didn't it?
Yeah, so it's the 1960s is a great deal of conversation about gun control, partly because of the assassinations in 63, 65, and 68, but partly because the homicide rate is very high in the 1960s. That's the kind of big crime wave, which has to do largely with demographics, the number of young people. And think about the baby boom. Think about the surge in the population of very young people in the 1960s, and it's young men who are the chief perpetrators and victims of homicide. So the homicide rate is skyrocketing, and then there are these devastating executions, assassinations, so that by 1968, especially in 1968, there's sort of a wave of gun control laws passed in municipalities and states across the country, including one in the District of Columbia. So, and they're not, there's much public discussion about them, but there's to some degree a fairly widespread consensus politically that gun control is a solution or a partial solution to this problem of homicide and a necessary response to these devastating assassinations.
My guest is Jill Lepore, who is a contributor to The New Yorker and also Harvard University history professor. She has an article in the current issue, in fact, on the matter of the Second Amendment and gun control. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When did the NRA first start getting into this whole story and getting involved in politics as well?
Not until really the late 60s and early 1970s, when the NRA, you know, looking at this wave of gun control legislation that dates to around 1968, becomes concerned and becomes increasingly active politically. 1980 is the first time the NRA endorses a presidential candidate. That's really not that long ago. I think it's important to remember someone endorsed Ronald Reagan. And with Reagan's presidency, we see the rise of a changing interpretation of the Second Amendment. The NRA argues, lawyers for the NRA argue that the Second Amendment protects not the rights of citizens to form militias, but it does in fact protect that, but in fact also protects the rights of individuals to bear arms. And it's not that the NRA fabricates this interpretation. This interpretation has certainly been made before 1968, but the NRA very actively promotes this interpretation. And so then there's a sizable debate about what the language of the amendment actually says. Previously, though, people had sort of felt, well, we needed gun control sort of regardless, right? This is an urgent social problem. But the NRA and its vocal opposition to the militia interpretation takes place at a time when there's a whole new theory of constitutional interpretation that has become politicized and become a big part of the work of the Reagan Justice Department under Edwin Meese, which is to promote an originalist interpretation of the Constitution. And it's the NRA that's arguing that the original interpretation of the Second Amendment is this individual rights argument, and that, in fact, it trumps any other interpretation, because the only way to interpret the Constitution is to go back to its original meaning.
And that constitutional originalism is pretty much the majority position of the current Supreme Court, isn't it? At least in regard to the Second Amendment, but also in interpreting all sorts of other laws.
Absolutely. I mean, and a lot of people on that court were appointed during those years. And, you know, some originalist sentiment became kind of litmus test for who would become a member of that court. So the court is overwhelmingly originalist, so much so that the big gun control decision that was handed down in 2008 in a case that tested the constitutionality of that gun control law passed in the District of Columbia in 1968 in the wake of those assassinations overturned that and sort of opened the door for the abolition of many gun control laws across the country on the grounds that that it violated the original sensibility of the Second Amendment. But even the dissent in that case in 2008, Heller versus the District of Columbia, was an originalist dissent. That's how widespread originalism has become, as if that were the only way to interpret the Constitution.
And originalism was part of the reasoning behind Citizens United, which involves another part of the Bill of Rights. But I guess originalism is something that all judges have to deal with today?
Well, you know, it has widespread support. It has, it certainly has become dominant in our discourse about the Constitution. It's become dominant, I think, publicly as well. There was really interesting work done at Columbia earlier this fall by some scholars in the law school at Columbia on the popular support for originalism. And 4 in 10 people in the United States will answer yes to the question, you know, does our interpretation of the Constitution need to go back to the original meaning of the drafters of the Constitution, or should it account for changing times? And people, you know, a lot of people discount that it should account for changing times, which is a big change in American political conversation and how we think about the law.
I should have pointed out this is the main subject of your most recent article in The New Yorker. Has the loosening of gun control laws led to the fact that the United States has the highest murder rate of any of the world's leading democracies, or is this have we had it through thick and thin?
We have a very unusual murder rate. It has been unusual from the beginning. At the moment, the United States has the highest homicide rate of any affluent democracy, and 4 times that of France and the United Kingdom, 6 times that of Germany. Our murder rate is extraordinarily high. It has been high from the start, according to somewhat sort of spotty records that are kept by a massive social science program known as the Historical Violence Database, which is this kind of fascinating compilation. We have really good data on murder from the 1930s on, because the FBI keeps these things called uniform crime reports, so we know a lot about the murder rate in the 20th century, but from earlier parts of American history, it's kind of patched together data. Nevertheless, although you can look at the murder rate in Europe declining steadily over centuries to the point where it's below 2 today throughout most of Western Europe. Here it's closer to 5.
Well, they have gun control laws in most of Europe, but was it lower even before they had those gun control laws?
Was the European murder rate lower before they had? Yeah, it was coming down. It was coming down all along. But even before Europe had gun control laws, the citizenry was largely unarmed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of incidental whether it's against the law or not. It's culturally not a significant factor at all. The other thing, of course, is that Western Europe has outlawed the death penalty, and we are an exception. This is another interesting form of American exceptionalism, and a tragic one, that we are, you know, one of the only countries that has a death penalty. And there have been arguments that the severity of punishments in any society will correspond to the severity of crime rather than reduce it.
The murder rate peaked in the early 1990s in places like New York City. Now it's gone into steep decline, and New York is one of the safest cities in the country. Do we have any reason to explain that other than changing demographics?
I think the demographics go a long way, and I think actually a lot of the explanations that are given by social scientists for shifts in the murder rate look to causes that are ancillary, but the demographics explains a lot. When those young baby boomers age out of that kind of murderous age where they really affect the murder rate, we've seen a real decline. But the murder rate is also higher in these so-called law and order states, which is interesting. And you know, New York State is not one of them. States with death penalty, states which actively deploy the death penalty, have a higher murder rate.
Isn't it odd that in most parts of the world where there are repressive governments, like Singapore, the crime rates are very low, but that doesn't seem to work in this country?
No, and there are really interesting theories that attempt to account for that difference. But I think, you know, like trying to understand the motives behind any assassination or any murder, at some level, some things evade explanation at the level of sociology. And I think at the level of psychology, too, it can be very hard to grapple with why that is the case. One of the explanations that has been promoted for the high American murder rate and its sort of intractability is that it has to do with our attitudes towards our government. It actually has to do with our politics, not in any sense of, you know, there's much conversation lately about the nature of our rhetoric, but to do with our distrust in our government, and that is actually part of how we understand ourselves as a people, that we pride ourselves on our skepticism about our government. And that
Gary LaFrie has come up with that, among others.
Yes, and that we cherish dissent, and that when we don't have faith in our government, the murder rate, with LaFrie's argument, the murder rate went up. And if you look at public opinion polls, LaFrie made this, you know, half-century-long study of public opinion polls where pollsters asked, how much of the time can you trust the government to do what is right? And at a time when people said, most of the time, the murder rate was low, and at a time when people said, you know, never, I don't trust this government, you know, like the Nixon administration. you can think about that. I mean, the murder rate was very high under the Nixon administration. I'm not convinced at all that these things correlate, but there is something deeper, which is, I have to do, I think, with gun ownership, which is we distrust the government enough that we want to defend the right to bear arms.
And two-thirds of all the murders in 2008 were from guns. I don't know. I guess the rest were strangulations and knives and things like that. But still, poisoning. But still, that's an awful lot. Have gun control laws fluctuated widely over the decades?
Yes, but the other thing that's fluctuated, and that why this is a difficult problem to solve quantitatively, is wound care and emergency response. So if you think about the murder rate over the past century, or even let's say you think about it over three or four centuries, you could die from a scratch in 1502. You can survive a gunshot wound to the chest today. So although the murder rate appears to be going down, in some ways it's the survival of assault rate that's going up.
As we've seen with Gabby Giffords, who seems to be going through some kind of miraculous recovery, despite the fact that a bullet went through her brain.
Well, I mean, we can certainly hope and pray that recovery continues. I think, but it does give you pause to rethink about even, you know, the kind of glib historical analyses that people will offer of the long-term history of political assassination. I think it's really important to think about the numbers of people who die from attempted assault now versus then. It completely changes our understanding of the data.
Jill, just one more thing about the data. The U.S. may have high homicide and gun ownership rates, but it also has the highest incarceration rates in the industrialized world, four times higher than it was 25 years ago. Shouldn't that be cutting down on all of this?
Well, it should be, but not if you buy the argument, which was prevalent in the 18th century and widely discussed as a matter of sort of hopeful enlightenment political thought, that the harsher the punishment, the more crime-ridden the society, that in fact harsh punishments just promoted criminality and promoted violence and a culture of violence. That's the argument that lay behind the abolition of the death penalty in much of the United States in the 19th century and in Europe during those years and into the 20th century. It's an argument that hasn't held water in large parts of the United States with the kind of return of the death penalty after 1976. We could look at the evidence, but I'm pretty persuaded myself that the death penalty plays a significant role in our homicide rate.
Jill LaPore is a contributor to The New Yorker. She also is a Harvard University history professor. And I want to thank you so much for participating in today's Backstory segment.
Thanks for having me.